WGBW 1590 AM Denmark, W250 CV Green Bay,
and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News. I'm Daria Albinger. Police in Washington, D.C. are asking the public for help as they investigate a deadly shooting.
Our real-time crime center began investigating and provided images from cameras in the area to aid in this investigation. Those vehicle images have been pushed out on our social media page. We urge anyone with any information pertaining to this incident who can help us, we ask you to call our detectives.
And Chief Pamela Smith says two gunmen got out of a car, opened fire on people in the neighborhood, and then fled. Sources say U.S. officials are skeptical Hamas is holding enough Israeli hostages to meet the requirements of the first phase of a proposed release deal. The National Weather Service headed to Slidell, Louisiana, where a reported tornado caused considerable damage today. The former assistant principal of an elementary school in Virginia, where a six-year-old shot his teacher last year, has been indicted on child abuse charges. The shooting left the teacher with life-threatening injuries. This is ABC News.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. Here's what Wisconsin needs to know. Communities around Wisconsin have more than doubled their property tax revaluation since 2020. Forward Analytics says local governments want to make sure property owners aren't underpaying their share in taxes if the market value on their homes is soaring while their assessed value stays flat. New worker safety regulations may have unintended consequences. The federal government now requires long-haul truckers to log their hours on wireless devices. But that could expose millions of trucks to hackers.
Those systems that never used to be connected to the internet or have any like wireless connections, they are becoming more and more connected, and that can introduce vulnerabilities.
Jake Jepson is the co-author of a study that shows how hackers can manipulate trucks remotely. And that's what you need to know. I'm Terry Bell, and this is Civic Media News.
If spring allergies keep you trapped inside, then you need Navage Nasal Care to keep you breathing clearly and enjoying all the beauties of spring. Navage helps clear nasal passages that are often clogged because of seasonal allergies. Navage gently flushes a pure, refreshing saline solution through your nasal passages to clear out congestion, sucking out that springtime pollen and other irritants trapped in your nose. Navage is available online at Navage.com or in stores at Walmart, Walgreens, CVS, Rite Aid, and Target. Navage, N-A-V-A-G-E.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home for Matinee on Air.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. Want to start out with some of my favorite people in government right now. And look, I've had a bunch of people saying, you know, why you support Joe Biden? And my response is always the same. Jennifer Bruzio, General Counsel at the National Labor Relations Board. Lena Khan over at the Federal Trade Commission. Julie Hsu, Secretary of Labor. Catherine Tai, the trade representative. All those folks. Because I think, the way I see it, and what I see them doing, moving in the right direction, fighting for working people. As I've said a million times, my true north is who's making things better for working people like us. And understand, you can easily take the Jennifer Abruzzo, the general counsel of the NLRB, compare it to the Trump person, and simple. Abruzzo, a labor person, fighting for labor rights, fighting for working people to, you know, organize the mission of the NLRA, you know, encourage collective bargaining. Whereas the Trump guy, Peter Robb, not so much. You could go look at Julie Hsu, the Secretary of Labor. Labor person, cares about working people. You could look at the Trump person. Eugene Scalia, not so much. Corporate lawyer, union buster. You know, it's simple. And you go, but Rick, you know, they're just two old guys fighting it out. Yeah, two old guys are fighting it out, and I agree. But who do they put in the positions that matter? Who do they put into the positions that are going to help either make conditions worse or make conditions better. I argue that Trump, as we talked about with schedule, his idea of Schedule F, making patronage great again, going to go after those, you know, those non-loyalists and put people into positions like the NLRB, like the Department of Labor, like all of those things that are supposed to help working people get that step forward. Well, their job would be to not so much. And I got to tell you, I loved the comment by Jennifer Abruzzo at the Roosevelt Institute's panel here recently, talking about SpaceX, Trader Joe's, and Amazon. You know, we talked about this the other day, that they are filing a lawsuit to make the NLRA or parts of it unconstitutional, which could throw labor relations in this country just into chaos, which would be just great for corporate America, especially SpaceX, Trader Joe's, and Amazon, where there are people who are, you know, trying to organize, fight for better wages, hours, conditions. But she says, and this is a beautiful statement, she says, it seems like a growing number of deep pocket, low road employers are jumping on the bandwagon, seeking preliminary injunctions in the court solely to slow down or prevent us from engaging in our enforcement actions against them because they have the money to do so. Unfortunately, she said, it seems to me that they would rather spend their money initiating court litigation rather than making their workers' lives and their own workplace operations better. She said, their primary goal, in my mind, is to divert our scarce resources away from protecting workers' rights to organize and to fight for the recognition and respect for the value that they add to their employers' operations. And that is not going to happen, she said. We are not going to postpone or cease our investigations or litigation or compliance or election work while we await the court to presumably resoundingly reject once again the long rejected challenges that have been launched against us. And look, the reality is, I love somebody who's going to go, look, we're not waiting around for this to be done. We're going to do our job. We're going to do what 89 years of decided law on their side has told them that they're going to do. Gives me hope. Gives me hope that the people that are in there now marching forward. Also, over at the Federal Trade Commission and the DOJ, they filed a statement of interest recently in this hotel algorithm fixing case. And this is something that, again, what I love that Biden's talking about is all the junk fees and all the ways corporate America is screwing us out of nickels and dimes here and all of this stuff. And I like the fact that the DOJ and the Federal Trade Commission are looking into this. What this case is about is you got these hotel chains, especially in areas where there isn't much competition to begin with because they've been bought up by big actors anyway. But they use these third-party corporations who have these algorithms who they figure out when people are going to be around, when things are going to be slow. You may have heard me talk about the idea of dynamic pricing. Wendy's wanted to try and go this route, actually made a public statement that they were going to go that way. And then when the public lost their minds, said, no, we've changed our minds. Trust me, it's coming back. They're not going to let go of this because it's so lucrative. And you go, okay, well, this is true capitalism, Rick. This is the law of supply and demand. This is all that stuff. You know, when you know more people want a good, the price should go up. So, you know, at lunchtime at Wendy's or McDonald's or wherever, that you know, dollar hamburger should go for $2 because there are more people wanting it. Scarcity. That's not competition. And again, remember, the idea of the free market is, well, you know, having the information, there being competition, and having the ability to abstain. What we're seeing is an awful lot of, I'm not going to call it collusion. Collusion's been one of those words that's been been beat up here recently. Let's call it, again, the word I liked all during the Trump years when they were talking about the Russian stuff was coordination. Now, understand the Department of Justice and the Federal Trade Commission in this this case, Cornish Adby versus Caesars Entertainment, which they're saying, look, you know, you can't collude on price fixing. You can't use this algorithm. This is one of those moments where you go, finally, someone looking out and using the laws we have, because they said, look, plaintiffs don't need to identify direct communications between competitors to allege an agreement under Section 1 of the Sherman Antitrust Act, particularly when they use this algorithm that does it for them. So there doesn't need to be that meeting. You know, to prove collusion, you needed in the past to go, okay, there were a bunch of people who got together in a smoke-filled room somewhere and said, we're not gonna rent a room for less than X amount of dollars. And it was hard to prove. This, a little different, because you have these apps. You have this algorithm that sets this stuff that can, well, raise prices at the drop of a hat. And look, we buy a lot of things online. I do as well. The power that we give those entities is pretty remarkable. I love the fact that finally someone's looking at this from a consumer's perspective. Is this best for the consumer? Is this, again, fostering competition? Because it seems to me, no matter where you go, it's all about the same. It seems like the game's already rigged. And it seems to me like it would be great to have a champion on our side. So for me, when I saw this stuff today, my mind went into this place of going, you know, this is the reason that you need a working class president. This is the reason you want working class folks in Congress. This is the reason you want to be voting for people who really do understand what it's like to work hard and sadly get screwed like we're getting. This is remarkable to me, and it's only one little thing. Imagine how much power these apps and these internet companies have over our daily lives. And have we begun to regulate? Have we begun to rein their power in? No. And I keep saying, while we're fighting over nonsense, we're not fighting for progress. And that progress should be making our lives better, shouldn't it? So I got to tell you, I love the fact that we've got decent people in these positions. But understand, come November, we make the wrong choices. This all goes away and we end up with, well, you know what we end up with. I want to hear your thoughts. Is this a good thing, a bad thing? Do you think hotels, you know, using an algorithm or a third-party company to, well, do their price fixing, think that's a good thing? Think it's good when you go to a baseball game that they have dynamic pricing? I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Going to take a quick break when we come back. China, some interesting stuff on the China front. Going to talk with our good friend Scott Paul. Back after this.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So the other day, I'm driving in the car, and you know, sometimes I do this to, so you don't have to. I turned on right-wing talk radio and left it on for probably an hour. And almost the entire time, all I heard was, well, the obvious Joe Biden bashing, but the EV bashing. How horrible electric vehicles are going to be, how horrible, you know, the whole thing, it's going to control your life. It's you know, they made some valid points on some points, but overall, wow, the hair on fire insanity of the next technology that could create jobs aplenty, especially for people in states that, you know, vote for them. Very, very interesting. And here to share some thoughts on why this hair on fire from the right wing over EVs and over the next generation of manufacturing jobs here in the country, I've asked our good friend Scott Paul to come talk with us. Scott is the president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing, AmericanManufacturing.org, the website. Scott, thanks for taking time for us.
Rick, it is always great to be with you.
So what do you make of this? I mean, I've been hearing, you know, all over social media, all over talk radio, all of these right-wing commentators, all of these Republican politicians just bashing the investment that Biden has made and that we're making in the future of transportation on the electrical vehicle front. I don't get it, especially considering a large amount of that investment being done in red states.
Yeah. You're right on all of those fronts. And I don't pretend like I can get inside the heads of those folks to articulate exactly what they're feeling or thinking. But, you know, I will say, you know, it is perfectly normal to be skeptical about a leapfrog technology, right? You know, or moving from the rotary phone to smartphones. Okay. So I get it. And it's whether you're uncomfortable with technology or you're just used to doing things a certain way. But I also think there's a bit of a political agenda here, and that there's some on the right that want to turn like batteries into the new mask, right? And it's just a cultural delineator. And that's an enormous mistake, because I think that, I don't know the time frame here, Rick, but it could be a decade, two decades, three decades. At some point in time, we're all going to be driving EVs, okay? That's just where the technology is headed, just like with the smartphones, okay? That's where we are headed. The only thing that is in question is how fast that's going to occur, number one, and then who's going to be making these vehicles? That's number two. And in the case of smartphones, even though we were pioneers in terms of the technology, almost all of the production occurred in China, and it still occurs in Asia. And we still don't make a single mass market smartphone in the United States. And so I want to be in the position when EVs really do catch fire, and they will, you know, it's just the early adopters right now. But when they do catch fire, that we're the country that's supplying them, and that it's not Mexico, it's not Korea, it's not China, it's in the United States. And it's because that means that there's going to be a whole lot of people who have good jobs in a lot of different states, not only making the EV vehicles, but also in the supply chains that are going to be supporting that manufacturer.
No, and I agree with you. It's inevitable that electric vehicles are the future. What I find interesting is, you know, all of these complaints, again, some I agree with. Look, I don't necessarily want central control and command of my vehicle. I don't want someone to be able to flip a switch and drive me wherever they want me to go. And look, there are some very real concerns there. How about we deal with that? Use the outrage, the anger, all the passion that's going into no to, well, you know, dealing with the problems that potentially could come up.
Yeah. Connected vehicle data security is a big concern. What most people don't realize is that their internal combustion engine vehicle is already connected if it's a relatively new model.
Shh.
And that there's the ability, and there have been documented successes at this. I know you've seen them too, where people have hacked into to vehicle systems. And so that's not limited to EVs. Like, that's with us right now. And that's a matter of data security and privacy and protection, no matter what kind of mobility choice that we're making in the United States. But I know one thing for damn sure, I don't want them to be Chinese vehicles, because then it's almost guaranteed that your data is getting back in some way on demand to the Chinese government. That would be a huge mistake. But that's not, that's not reason alone to give them up. And I just want to focus just on performance for a second. You rightly point out that, as a truck driver, any kind of driver, the experience in refueling is different for gas powered versus EV right now. And that's totally true. Okay. That is true, but it is changing and it is getting better every day. And it is not too far on the horizon where you'll see in a parking lot of a grocery store or, a retail store, something that looks like a gas station, but will have those chargers, where you'll be able to go into that retail store and your car will be charged by the time you come out. And so it's a little bit of a different pattern for folks. Or if you sit down in a restaurant, it's going to be the same kind of thing. Or as you point out, Rick, at a truck stop, the technology will be there to get you from 10% up to 80% in the same amount of time, pretty much as if you went in there and you took a bathroom break, you got a bite to eat, you stretched your legs or whatever, you made a couple of calls and you come back out.
Yeah,
right?
No. Yeah, I brought that up to you during the break is, I've been seeing all these social media posts of people going, in 15 minutes you can refuel a truck and, be on the road and drive 1,200 miles. And I'm going, I don't know. I've never been in and out of a truck stop in 15 minutes. I don't know what you're talking about. Because it's at least an hour every time I stop in one of these truck stops. Let's at least talk on the right levels. But I'm hoping you're right. I'm hoping we get to the place where, it's just something different, the nightmare that they've presented for us.
Right. And it will, and this is the thing, it's like, name a technology that was perfect when it was first introduced, right? Whether it's anything in robotics or anything in electronics, they work the glitches out. And that's where we're beyond the beta phase now. Now it's just a matter of building up that capacity.
Right.
And it will come. And I will just say, as someone who, has been in a number of electric vehicles and in internal combustion engine vehicles, there is a lot to love about the acceleration and performance of those EVs. It is pretty extraordinary once you experience it. And there is also a great joy in not paying a dime for gasoline, I'm just going to say. So it feels really good not to do that. And so people will catch on to that and word will spread, but it is we're at the very early stage of this. It's like the people you saw initially who had the iPhones and you're like, oh, that'll never catch on.
No, not the iPhones, the bag phones. I remember having a bag phone going, this is garbage. I don't know why I pay for this.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. We're kind of in, we're struggling through this happens all the time with like the types of work that we do. And, I'm old enough where I took like a typewriting class in high school. You may have as well, where you learned how to type on an actual typewriter. And then within 5 years, no one was using typewriters anymore. So It's going to happen.
Yep.
But I want the jobs to be here. If you adopt the Republicans' approach to this, there will be EVs in the United States eventually, and they'll all be made in China. And that's going to be a terrible outcome, one that we don't want to see.
No, because, you know, I was just reading an article. I think it was at the Wall Street Journal. And they were talking about the next shock of China just dumping and flooding, you know, the world with cheap stuff. And, you know, my mind goes to, you know, for decades now, I've been talking about how bad tearing down, you know, capital and capital borders are, and how bad it's been for tearing down, you know, borders for goods and services, because you're going to have someone like this who is going to dominate the industry and drop the floor out of the bottom. And that's bad for, you know, economies that are high wage economies like ours. And for me, I think we're in a moment where potentially maybe we start erecting some of those borders again to protect our industries and our way of life and our standard of living. And yes, I'm a protectionist. I make no bones about it. I'm not an isolationist. I've said this before. When I leave the house, I lock the door. I don't have a giant moat around my house, but I do make sure that what we need in our home is protected. And I think as a country, we've got to start thinking that way again.
Yeah, there is no shame in defending your jobs and defending your quality of life, right? I mean, that is what we all are built to do. And I think what we expect our policymakers to do as well. And so the challenge that you point out is that first, China has had a head start on all of this. They viewed EVs very much as a leapfrog technology early and invested a ton of money in it and used our technology, you know, basically through joint ventures or forced technology transfers or just outright theft, and build up the capacity to do this with tens of billions of dollars in state subsidies. And now they have so much industrial capacity in automobiles in China that it's about 5 to 10 million units more than they have demand in China. And so that's 5 to 10 million units that they need to sell somewhere else in the world. And just, you know, the U.S. auto market in any year is about a $15 million unit market, which is large, but it can't absorb the kind of shock that you would see coming from these Chinese imports, which, by the way, are also impossibly priced. It's right. Like you can get an SUV for like $14,000, and you're like, how is that even possible? It's like, well, if you have a supply chain that's built on slave labor, if you have all these massive subsidies, and if you're selling it cheaper here, you know, in other markets, that's what you can do. And so that's going to be the playbook. And we've seen it. We know how this turns out, Rick. We know we've seen it in steel. We saw it in glass. We saw it in paper. We saw it in semiconductors. We saw it in microelectronics. We know how it turns out is that we will just become consumers rather than producers. And it will not make our country better off if we're just consumers of automobiles and not producers of them.
You know, it comes back to the question I keep asking, and I've been asking for years: are you a worker first or a consumer first? And that's gonna you know, guide your choices on who you vote for, on what you purchase, on all of that stuff. Are you worried about your job, or hey, I can get cheap stuff, get a whole basket full of it? Now, the thing that gets me is, I look at where our politicians are, and they seem to be, especially on the right, bashing these EVs. And I talk to, you know, working people every day who don't know what's really going on because our media seems to be all over the place.
Yeah.
I don't think the Biden administration has done a good enough job of going, hey, look, we're investing in these facilities. These are real people getting real jobs. This is real infrastructure being built. This is a real future. Or am I just, you know, maybe not seeing the right things?
You are totally seeing it. And here's the thing. I mean, this is very dangerous for Republican lawmakers to do, because if you look at the states where you've seen a lot of this EV investment, you're looking at places like Michigan and Ohio. You're looking at Tennessee and Kentucky. You're looking at Alabama and Georgia. And, you know, a couple of those states are swing states, right? You know, and so it is like there's great peril in that. And there are workers right now who I guarantee are registered Republicans who have a job building batteries or building EVs who are, you know, if they see their lawmakers are like, you know, want to put them out of business, that's not a good look for a policymaker to have. So they ought to really think twice about how politicized they're trying to make these EVs. And, you know, everybody from Trump on down, I think it's a huge mistake to do this. And yeah, it's easy to poke fun at a new technology, just like it was for the people who had iPhones initially. But there are billions of them sold in the world every year right now, and we don't make a single damn one of them right here. And so that cannot happen with EVs. So we cannot follow where Republicans want to lead us.
No, I'm right there with you, which is why, you know, if we're moving in this direction, I want us to be have the corner on the market, at least domestically. I mean, look, China can produce for China, but I've always and I'll say it again, I've said it a million times, I'm a big believer in domestic production for domestic consumption should be made here, especially this kind of cross-border technology with the ability to, as you pointed out as well, to be able to control those vehicles from afar. I don't think I want the Chinese Communist government in charge of that. I just don't. But Scott, as always, great stuff. Appreciate the time. I'll look forward to talking to you again real soon.
You bet. Happy to be with you, Rick. Appreciate it.
Our good friend Scott Paul. What do you think? Are EVs the future? You looking forward to getting one, or are you in the camp of, no, I want my gas guzzler? I want to know. Let me know. Rick@therickSmithshow.com. Right back.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW. Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. Mostly cloudy skies into the overnight, mid-40s by sunrise with light winds. On Thursday, break out that umbrella. Shower chances making their way into the region. Highs in the mid-50s. Showers continue Thursday night. Lows in the mid-40s. It's 57 at our studios.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba.
This is April Fool's Day. Did you fall for any jokes today, Conrad?
Well, I guess I did fall for one, but it was unfair because it happened last week.
Yeah, what the heck?
Hot dog water from 7-Eleven.
We both fell for that, but that's not even... It's like, after the Kurter Burger, I'll believe anything. I could believe it was hot dog water, and that was like March 26th. That's so lame.
They actually did make it, though.
Good.
Got some people to actually drink it.
Suckers.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba. Weeknights 7 till 9 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Well, as the 2024 presidential election rapidly approaches, the importance of talk radio cannot be overstated. Talk radio serves as a vital platform for political discourse, providing a space for diverse voices, yours, mine, ours, and opinions to be heard by millions of folks across the country. In this crucial election year, talk radio has the potential to shape public opinion, influence voter behavior, and even, I hope not, in a way, impact this election. That's why I've asked Michael Harrison to come talk with us. He's the founder and publisher of Talkers Magazine, the talk radio Bible, the go-to publication for everything talk radio. Michael, thanks for taking time for us.
Rick, it's great to be with you. Thank you, and thank you for the fine work that you do within this medium.
So let's jump right into this. I hear all the time talk radio is not relevant. Is talk radio relevant in this age of podcasts and the internet?
Well, I have personally been active in talk radio since 1975, and we started Talkers in 1990, and there hasn't been a day that's gone by all the way back to the beginning where I don't answer the question, is talk radio about to die? Is talk radio relevant? Does anybody listen? And lately, there's a lot of, is radio about to die? But they've been saying that for a long time, even before I was even in the business. I've been in the radio business since the late 60s, and people were asking those questions. So, Mark Twain said, the news of my death has been greatly exaggerated. As long as people are asking whether something is still relevant and whether it's dying, that means it's relevant. Otherwise, no one would ask. It would just be gone. So yes, talk radio is very relevant, and radio is very relevant. And I won't say they're here to stay, but they're going to be here for quite a while going forward.
They may not be the long-term future, but they are the here and now. But, you know, I keep hearing people go, everyone's got a podcast, Michael. So, you know, it's not the 1950s or the 1940s where radio was king, but how much radio, how much reach do you think talk radio has compared to other forms of media in this moment? The podcast, the internet, the YouTubes, all that stuff.
The only forms of media that are really, really growing and dominant are the big tech media, YouTube, Facebook, X, Instagram. The big tech media have taken the lunch out of the traditional media's, you know, off the table, and mostly in advertising and in terms of buzz. So I would say that all media here in the 21st century, and we're getting deeper into the 21st century, we've got a quarter of it already under our belts, all media is fighting more competition for increasingly smaller pieces of the media pie. This is not a radio thing. Look at movies, look at television, look at newspapers, magazines, look at the record industry. They've been so disrupted by the fractionalization imposed by digital media. So to single radio out is not, it's not an accurate or a fair depiction. With that being said, radio remains relative to itself and to the here and now, as you point out, extremely important. I'm not going to get into the most important medium and all of that because times are changing so quickly. The question is rhetorical at this point.
And the reality is, you know, anyone can have a podcast. It's a matter of is anyone listening to it? And, you know, we're on about 50 stations across the country and we get feedback from people all across the country. Our podcast, you know, doesn't have the same numbers that our radio audience does because honestly, we don't spend a lot of time promoting that podcast. But, you know, that is part of the future, isn't it? I mean, you've got to, in this day and age, whether you're terrestrial, whether you're on TV as we are, you've got to be in the podcast space. You got to be in the internet space. You've got to be all over the place. You can't just, at least I don't think, be in one arena.
Well, it depends on how you are branding yourself. I mean, the word brand is a very important word, and we can get into a discussion of that for hours. But branding is very important. However, the key is to have all of your different platforms work in harmony as opposed to cannibalize themselves. I mean, so much of the popularity of the aforementioned big tech media platforms was fueled by attention, absolute fawning attention given to them by radio and newspapers and traditional media. It's like, don't you see that it's a competition? Don't you see if you have a radio show when you say, go listen to a podcast, that in fact you're telling people to tune out the radio show? Everybody's in competition with everything, including ourselves. We're in our brand is in competition with the different platforms. So it's important for a media practitioner to get them in harmony and get them balanced so that the brand is promoted, but not at the expense of the place where the numbers are important. I know it's a little complicated, but these are complicated times. Yeah. Anybody can have a podcast. Look, anybody can have a typewriter or now a keyboard. That doesn't make you the next great American novelist. Anybody can go out and play baseball at the local park. It doesn't make it Yankee Stadium. Anybody can put on a play in their backyard or in the community theater or in their high school, but it doesn't make it Broadway. We can't lose sight of what the big time means. And for radio, for professional radio to survive and succeed, it's got to provide the best audio entertainment out there, or it will just fade into the background like so many podcasts that nobody listened to.
It's an excellent point. And I want to go back to the 2024, the election is you know only a couple of months away. You know, I look at the talk radio landscape and it is overwhelmingly conservative voices. And I've got friends who believe that because of that prowess, that power that the right has over the talk radio sphere, that potentially you could see this election moving in that direction. Does talk radio have that kind of power?
Well, talk radio, all media has power. Talk radio has tremendous power when it comes to politics. And most commercial talk radio is indeed self-described as conservative. However, all radio is not commercial talk radio. We don't talk about public radio as being radio. We think it's apples and oranges. It's not. Public radio is radio too. It's the same dial, AM, FM, podcasts, online, the whole thing. It's the same basic set of platforms. It's radio. And, you know, public radio, and I'm not talking about just NPR, because public radio is bigger than just NPR. Public radio will deny that it's left of center. Oh, no, we're not biased. They have their own version of fair and balanced. But the fact of the matter is, basically, when you look at radio, the big picture of radio, all news radio, sports talk radio, news talk radio, and the commercial and the public radio stations, because it's the same dial, I'd say that all points of view are presented. The problem with today's media, and it's part of your question, is that instead of putting it out there and seeing what comes back, today's media practitioners target audiences based on what they see as a vacuum and an opportunity to get an audience and to be able to get clicks and eyeballs and eardrums and sales and subscriptions and likes and all of that stuff. And they cater to what people already believe. In other words, there's a lot of preaching to pre-selected choirs I call it the daily dance of affirmation, telling people what they want to hear, as opposed to telling people what you know, what you think, and let the chips fall the way they may. This has been a major change in the recent, I'd say 10 years, 15 years, and I find it to be disturbing, and I find it to be dangerous.
Do you think it's the end of the medium, or do you think it will only make it bigger as people seek their silos? I fear that by having, you know, silos in this form where we never talk to each other, we stop talking to each other.
And as a result, we don't have a national popular culture. As a result, it actually disintegrates the foundation of nationhood. And this is a problem facing the United States today, is that we see it as polarization. We see it as insurmountable obstacles to communicating with each other. But it's actually these bubble universes, these echo chambers, as we call them, that are tearing people apart. And when we don't have a common national culture, you know, there's no Ed Sullivan show on Sunday night. We recently had the Oscars. Most people haven't even seen any of the movies and can't even name what movie won. Oppenheimer, because it became part of the pop culture with Barbie. That was in the news. Two movies the whole year. I mean, come on. Think of the world you grew up in. What song is number one on Billboard? Does anybody know? What's the best-selling book in the country? Does anybody know? The popular culture that defines a nation has disintegrated, and therein lies a lot of the problems we're having in terms of cohesiveness and communicating.
Now, if you ask, you know, either side, the red hat or the blue hat, it's the other side's fault. Whose fault is it?
Well, it's all of our fault. Since when has any politician or political party represented pure virtue? I mean, you know, if anything, one of the things we're learning in this era of scams and deceit is that most of our institutions we have to protect ourselves from the institutions we used to rely on as being true and supportive and honest. You know, big tech, big pharma, big religion, big government. I mean, the Democrats and the Republicans, neither side can be counted on for truth, honesty, and for heroes. Where are the statesmen or statespeople? Where are they? There has been a deterioration in principles, in the idea of glory, in the idea of a higher principle and something to strive for. These are the problems we face. To fix this is going to take a long time because education becomes involved, parenting gets involved, the principles of a culture. What kind of a culture, what kind of a people are we? When the political parties, Democrats or Republicans, preach fear demonization of the other side, every little thing demonized, every little possible flaw that you can find in the opponent cherry-picked and presented, the problems are far greater than who's to blame.
No, but you could make the argument that, you know, You know, talk radio magnifies those differences. You've got politicians who are now more concerned about clicks and views and getting their name on the podcast circuit than actually passing legislation that are going to make people's lives better.
Yeah. Well, I mean, but if you look back in history, the modern technology of social media and the rapid pace at which we communicate with each other and the access we have to everything in the world that ever existed only amplifies something that has always gone on. There's always been yellow journalism. There's always been corruption in politics. If you look up how many elected officials have been arrested or imprisoned, the list is, I thought I was going to find like 20 or 40, hundreds and hundreds over history, all the way back to the beginning. Yeah. Corruption in the public space has always been prevalent. I don't know if things are getting worse. I think they're just getting louder. It's a noisy world, and we're becoming ill from it, while other people thrive on it. A lot of people see this as a blood sport, as a spectator sport. They don't know a damn thing about issues or politics, but they love the battle. They've forgotten the difference between getting excited about the fantasy of a football game and the fantasy in their mind that they have their egos invested in, but not their brains, of a political election.
No, and again, I keep coming back. My true north has always been, how do we make the lives of working people better? How do we make that kid growing up in the housing project that I grew up in, how do we get that kid the opportunities, at least the opportunities that I've had, if not better? And sadly, I don't see that coming out of our politics. So, you know, with the election coming around, what are you seeing as the main messages coming out of talk radio on all sides? Is there a central theme that you see? Because again, we're in our silos of red hat, blue hat. What are you seeing?
What I see is a common theme that you can't trust anybody, that you can't trust the judiciary, that you can't trust the legislature, that you cannot trust the executive branch, that you can't trust your local dog catcher, that you can't trust the DA, that you can't trust the hospitals. I find that there is an increase in distrust. And I believe that if I had to find a common theme of talk radio or any of the talk media that talk radio has spawned or any opinion, editorial oriented media, I find that to be the predominant message is that you can't trust anybody.
No, I'm right there with you. Michael, I appreciate the time. I want to pick up some more of this on the other side in our podcast forum. But Michael Harrison, Talkers Magazine, appreciate the time.
Thank you, Rick.
For our Free Speech TV audience, for our radio affiliates across the country, if you want to check out more of my conversation here with Michael Harrison, go to our website, thericksmithshow.com, where you will find the full interview with Michael Harrison of Talkers Magazine. Going to take a quick break. Right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 2006. That was the day of massive protests for immigrants' rights in cities throughout the United States. Starting in March of 2006, there was a series of coordinated protests in response to a bill passed by the United States House of Representatives. The bill would classify undocumented workers as felons, and it proposed a wall be built along one-third of the U.S.-Mexican border. In total, more than 5 million people across the country protested that spring. And on this day, protests were held in more than 100 cities. On May 1st, or May Day, large protests reached numbers not seen since the civil rights demonstrations of the 1960s. CNN described the impact of the protests in Chicago, reporting kids skipped school, men and women walked off their jobs, others didn't bother to go to work, businesses shut down for lack of patrons, or employees. The protesters dubbed the May Day event a day without immigrants. The aim was to withhold immigrant labor and buying power to show their impact on the U.S. economy. A study by the Pew Hispanic Center found that at the time, undocumented workers made up 24% of farm labor and 14% of construction labor in the United States. The protests had an impact. The bill that would harshen penalties for undocumented workers did not pass the Senate. The AFL-CIO also recognized the importance of reaching out to immigrant workers. In August of 2006, the AFL-CIO introduced a national worker center partnership. For the first time, worker centers, many of which organize immigrant workers, could enter into formal partnerships with the AFL-CIO. Working with immigrant workers remains an important front in today's labor movement.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
A new study commissioned by the International Institute for Democracy and Electoral Assistance. International IDEA is the name of the group. What they found, and I guess not surprising, voters around the world have shown widespread skepticism around the idea that elections are free and fair, and many, many favor a strong, undemocratic leader. And it's kind of shocking to me that we're in this moment, because understand, we've been pursuing this idea of democracy, of rule of the governed, my entire lifetime. This has been the great American experience. The survey, the Perceptions of Democracy survey, polled voters in 19 countries, including three of the world's largest democracies, Brazil, India, and here at home in the U.S. And not great. In the U.S., experts evaluated the terms. Understand, we're supposed to have the most highly performing democracy, while only 47% of the people who responded said that they had faith in a credible electoral process. You got to give the right wing credit. They have really done a masterful, and look, the left as well. They've done a masterful job at tearing at elections. 17 of the 19 countries polled, fewer than half, according to this study, fewer than half of the people are satisfied with their government, and only four countries have a majority of people who feel that they're doing better than their parents. 11 of the 19 countries, fewer than half of the people say that the last election was free and fair. In 18 of 19 countries, fewer than half of the people believe the courts always or often provide access to justice. In India and in Tanzania, a majority of the population are satisfied with the government's their performance. India and Tanzania also stand out as countries with relatively high levels of support for a strong leader. They don't have to bother with that whole, parliament or elections or any of that. Colombia, Romania, Brazil, and Sierra Leone, the poorest in society, they say that they approve of government performance over the rest. I found it interesting that in Iraq, Iraqis have more faith in access to justice in their court system, 28% always or often, than we do here at home, 26%. You stop and you think about that one thing. Things have become so polarized, so politicized, so demonized that the court system, which used to be the place where we sought some bit of fairness, where the person at the front of the court was supposed to be the arbiter of justice, not of ideology. And what we've done with this system, again, we've destroyed what was a great system by political polarization. I know. But Rick, the court systems of, it's always done. Not to this level. I mean, I look at what's going on in the red hat, blue hat world. And the first thing, and I do it too. I'm now of the mindset, who appointed them? There used to be this deference to law, this love of the law, this idea that the law was above red hat, blue hat, Democrat, Republican. It was above that. It was the foundation of this country. And when you undermine the rule of law, when you destroy that institution that the people believe is going to, at least be somewhat fair, you know, Lady Liberty and Justice with the blindfold, and you know, we're gonna balance it out. It's one of the ways authoritarian leaders weaken democracy. If you weaken the rule of law, if you get the electorate to believe that there's no such thing as fairness, that there are no rules that apply, that the rich and the powerful can manipulate the legal system, that you know you can use law enforcement to target your political opponents. The fact that, and this is what blows my mind, the fact that law enforcement has become such a political football. I said from the very beginning, we had someone on the show who said, well, we're going to defund the police. And I'm like, no, that's dumb. Don't do that. We're not defunding the police. You should fund the police to where they have more resources to be able to deal with certain issues differently. I'm all in favor of that. But don't say dumb things like defund the police. It's bad messaging and it's bad policy. How about we stop allowing the police to deal with all of societal's problems? How about we stop creating an environment where they're the trash collectors and have to deal with all of society's ills? Because we've cut funding to mental health. We've stopped trying to defeat poverty. We've stopped trying to end homelessness. We've stopped trying to do all of these things while then heaping all these mandates on the police. As I said from the beginning, I support the police when they're not wrong. When they're doing their job, when they're doing what we ask them to do, when we doing what we have tasked them to do, I am 100% in support. Now, do you get some people who go outside of that? Yeah, and those folks I don't support. See, we used to be able to think like this, but evidently it's become hot potato. It's red hat, blue hat. I got to be on one side, the other's got to be on the other side, and we shall fight each other. Without any, hey, we actually do need police. You need some bit of law enforcement. You need some bit of stability. And this is what the authoritarian crowd wants. They love the fact that the law is now, well, it's a patronage game. And this idea that elections are all jerry-rigged and, you know, you can do all kinds of voter suppression and voter fraud and intimidate people and do all the things that authoritarians of the past have always done. It's one of the ways you destroy democracy. You manipulate elections. It's the reason Saddam Hussein got 98% of the vote. It's the reason Vladimir Putin gets, you know, an outrageous number of the vote. Not because people want him, but because it's a rigged game and everyone knows it. We still have the opportunity to go and cast our ballots in free and fair elections. No one has brought forth evidence to say here in this country, the election was rigged. Now, a lot of people believe it. Oh, they believe to their core. They're the same ones who believed when the solar eclipse was happening that they were going to be raptured up into the sky. And I hope they were, because we could do without them. But we're in this moment where this election really is about, do you believe in democracy or do you not? You know, we could talk about all the other things, and I do, the economic side of things, the justice side of things, the good policy on reshoring manufacturing and investing in infrastructure and helping our kids and helping the homeless, all that stuff. But if democracy dies, all that goes with it. None of it matters. If this wonderful experiment of self-rule ends, because we've allowed the Trumpkins and the MAGA hats and the rest of them to weaken our independent institutions, to destroy the judiciary, to destroy our legislative bodies, to destroy the electoral process. If we allow them to do that and replace them, pack them with loyalists, you know, making patronage great again, this liberty and this freedom that we have as Americans will go away. Because look, we've already got the cult of personality. Donald Trump is that cult of personality that history will remember him for. The propaganda, the rhetoric that we see all around him, this idea that he put his head on Rambo's body and he's the greatest enemy of... It's insane. And the more I look at this, the more I say, you know what? We do need a sense of sanity and you look at the fact that there is corruption and cronyism and all of the things that are going on around us, and I find it really ironic. Honestly and truthfully, I find it really ironic that the right keeps looking at, pointing at Joe Biden going, he's corrupt, when the guy that, the Trumpkin guy, that's the corrupt guy. But I guess we can't have those conversations because we've got to quash that ability to interact and to talk to each other and to challenge each other. The hope is we get back out in the streets and we engage in that discussion and that fight for democracy. I want to hear your thoughts. Could this be the last free and fair election that we have in our lifetime, as some have told me? And are you willing to fight for what we have or watch it go away? I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Miss any portion of the program, grab the podcast. And as always, I appreciate you being here. See you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Email Rick at rick@therickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to...
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay.
WGBW 1590 AM Denmark. W250 CV Green Bay.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.